Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. As populist candidates in Europe win elections and form new governments, the future of the European Union is called into question. In Poland, Hungary, and more recently Italy, new governments have taken an anti-EU stance, questioning the viability and wisdom of economic integration. Other more traditional leaders, like Germany's Angela Merkel and France's Emmanuel Macron, worried that the commitment to liberal democratic values and the resistance to European meddling will be a thing of the past. Global markets are also uneasy, concerned that countries will leave the euro. In this week's episode, we will delve into the future of the European project, Europe's most significant experiment since World War II. Joining us will be Heather Graby, Executive Director of the Open Society Foundation's European Policy Initiative, and Charles Litchfield, European and Eurasian Affairs Specialist with the Eurasia Group. Moderating this program is our co-host, Ray Suarez. The program is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to the conversation with Ray Suarez.
If Americans think much about the European Union at all, it may be as a bureaucratic supergovernment, but also one that did a lot of what it was supposed to accomplish. It kept two big European powers that had been at the center of phenomenally destructive wars, Germany and France, at peace and even friendship with each other. The encouragement of capitalism and smoothly operating democracy in countries where it was fragile or new, like Portugal, Spain, and Greece. After the Cold War, the Union pushed east, encouraging the transition to democratic order in the Warsaw Pact and ex-Yugoslavia. In so many ways, a good news story. But now, Italy holds its latest elections in March, and its two big winning parties are both hostile to the EU and the euro. Britain is heading for the exit. Greece bridles under the severe restrictions that followed its economic meltdown. One of the brightest stars of the post-Soviet East, Poland, is tampering with legal norms introduced after the Iron Curtain dissolved. Hungary is flirting with chauvinism and strongman rule. What happened? Heather Graby, instead of triumphalism, a crabby, quarreling EU. Why?
There's plenty of crabby, quarreling democracies across the world at the moment. It's not surprising a whole generation after the end of the Cold War, 30 years later, that the triumphalism of liberal internationalism has faded and many people are questioning what can and should be done at regional level and international level. We're seeing a return of a focus on national sovereignty in many countries and a huge growth of populism. What's quite remarkable about the European Union in this context is how resilient it has proven despite enormous crises. I think that actually Winston Churchill's view on democracy is very apt here. He said, "Democracy is the worst form of government except all the others that we've tried from time to time." You could say the same about the European Union. It's the worst form of organizing Europe except all the others that we've tried over the centuries.
Charles Litchfield, is there a risk of exaggerating Europe's predicament?
I think there is, and I think it's quite tempting just because there's such variety in Europe, so many different countries, different constitutional systems. It's also, and I may be disparaging my own profession to an extent, but it's also very tempting to construct scenarios which are sensationalist and always seem to describe that everything's about to collapse. When actually, if you look at public opinion, especially after the Brexit vote, there is still support for there being a European Union. And I agree entirely with Heather that the way the European Union works can and should be criticized. But so far, we haven't really found a better way of operating. And I think electorates do understand that there should be an EU, but that reform is necessary.
Well, let's look at the particular case of Italy. Italians were among the most stalwart Europeans. Even amidst decades of government fragility, dozens of governments after the Second World War, the EU was stable when Italian parties were not. Now, two big winners, the League of the North and the Five Star Movement, are talking of a referendum on following the British out the door. Heather?
Well, for many decades, Italians looked to the EU institutions for the kind of stability and good governance that they weren't finding in their domestic institutions. And actually, public support is still there. There's still a majority of Italians who believe in the European Union. What's in question is, I think, actually the whole realm of public policy and particularly governance of the economy. And that's where the Lega and where Five Star have done very well by saying to Italians, look, things are not getting better. Still huge problems with governance in Italy, still huge problems with the economy. Things don't work well for most Italians. The backbone of the Italian economy, small and medium-sized enterprises, function despite rather than because of rule from Rome. So the question is now whether looking to the EU or trying to fend off the EU is actually going to deliver the kind of results that the Italian people want. And that's not something that the Lega and Five Star have presented a clear program on. They haven't said how having less involvement of the European Union and Italy being less engaged in the EU would somehow solve those problems at national level. It's still really quite vague and identity-based in terms of arguments. It's not really about public policy alternatives. And that's actually what would really change things in Italy.
Charles, not about public policy alternatives? Looking back, I lived in Italy before the euro existed. And whenever the Italian government or Italian governments, there were many during the time I was there, got in trouble, they just inflated their way out of trouble and waited till the next government to clean up the mess. Right now, Italians owe 132% of annual GDP in accumulated debt. And yet at the same time, there's anti-euro sentiment, it seemingly because Italians want to be able to revert to that course whenever they need to.
Yes, I think it's very important to remember that neither of these parties that almost started governing together were particularly honest or straight about whether they wanted to leave the euro or wanted to create a path whereby Italy could leave the euro without leaving the EU. This was never particularly clear during the campaign, and when it arrived in a draft coalition agreement, this was the first sort of alert for markets. As your listeners will know, the Italian president intervened by not accepting the nomination of an Eurosceptic finance minister, and that has led us to the current crisis we're in. It's important also to remember that obviously, the Euroism is unpopular in Italy, especially in the south, and there's this sort of nostalgia for a period where devaluations of the Italian currency simply helped the country exit crises. That may be true, but it is also the case that the north of the country, where Lega Nord is very popular, exports very successfully, and I don't think Italy would benefit from leaving the euro. It'd actually make things much more difficult for them, especially with their debt burden. The Italian president seems to believe that he's within his mandate in blocking this finance minister. But the problem I suppose we have now is that the populist parties, which weren't particularly clear about wanting to leave the euro, now do have a very sort of snappy case to make to the Italian electorate that elites have intervened in internal democratic processes in Italy, and that the next election is their chance to express their feelings about that. So that's the danger of the next election.
Staying with Italy for a bit, Heather. They're not playing a strong hand. They've got an aging population, a rapidly aging population. For some time now, Italians have been having children below replacement rate, yet they are hostile to high levels of immigration. Productivity in Italian industry is failing to keep pace with European partners, let alone the worldwide standard in productivity increases. There's severe inequality in the regions. The EU helps paper over some of these problems inside Italian society, doesn't it?
The EU has been important in providing a framework and a reference point for Italian politics, and particularly the euro has provided, of course, a fiscal discipline, which has constrained many of the policy options of previous governments. And perhaps that's a good thing. It stopped some of the boom and bust inflation-oriented policies of previous governments. But the tricky problem is that the EU cannot solve fundamental structural issues. The EU's role in restructuring of economies and changing macroeconomic policy is really limited to what it calls the open method of coordination, i.e. providing examples of best practice, providing advice and so on. Ultimately, the EU is in fact not the IMF, and neither is it a European finance ministry. So it's ultimately going to be up to Italian politicians to make the required changes. The EU has provided a large amount of money over the years through the structural funds, particularly to regions, to pay for motorways and infrastructure of that kind. Some of that money has been wasted. Some of it has directly benefited various organized crime networks in the country. And now the EU is looking at how to spend that money more effectively. The budget commissioner, Günther Oettinger, has made a proposal where Italy would actually get more money from the EU budget, but with new kinds of conditions on how it's spent, particularly around how making sure that the money is spent efficiently without problems of either leakage or spending it on the wrong kinds of priorities, and also potentially conditions on rule of law. So that will make a difference, but ultimately what really matters is what happens in Italy itself.
Charles Litchfield, would the Italian crisis, such as it is, and we're waiting to see what the outcome is, be less pressing if there weren't already problems elsewhere in the Union, whether it's Brexit, even the European core, the E2, you might call it, France and Germany are having problems in their famously coordinated and harmonious relationships over the decades. Right now, a relative newcomer to electoral politics, Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel, are not seeing eye to eye.
No, first of all, I think the Italian crisis that we're observing now would be a big problem with or without challenges in other countries. That is simply because of the size of Italy's economy. It's not the same size as Greece, as Portugal, as Ireland, other countries that have, other Eurozone member states that have had gone through political and financial turmoil. Italy is the third biggest economy of the Eurozone. Some of its regions are actually very productive and very important to Europe's economy. And so for it to be going through a period where it's the bond yields spike, where political uncertainty means that the rest of the Eurozone can't really plan on its own reform, is a big problem, regardless of what may be going on in Spain or elsewhere. You mentioned France and Germany's harmonious relations over 40 years. It's certainly the case that they've been friendly relations. I wouldn't necessarily say they've always seen eye to eye on everything. And what we see at the moment in the Franco-German negotiations on this roadmap they're trying to put together on Eurozone reform reflects, I think, long-standing philosophical differences. Mr. Macron obviously wants to sort of put a new impulse into the EU project, and his the fact that Mrs. Merkel has managed to put together a coalition with the Social Democrats could be seen as a blessing, although it's not a particularly energetic coalition. They have in their own coalition agreement a big statement that they also want to relaunch the European project. But as far as I can tell now, and I'm sure Heather will have interesting things to say on this too, there's still a lot of reluctance in Berlin to get behind Macron's ideas for reforming the Eurozone. And so the differences between Paris and Berlin seem to still endure.
Is it unusual, looking over the history of the EU, to have so much ruction in so many places at the same time? Is that really the problem? Not that Europe can't handle these things, but usually gets to, often gets to, take them on one at a time, rather than having all these small brush fires going at the same time.
Yes, I agree with you that the EU has been through some extremely difficult times over the past, 8 years now. First of all, a sovereign debt crisis that it wasn't prepared for, didn't have the instruments to fight against. A migration crisis, which different countries had different responses to, and the fact that their borders have been removed within the EU should mean that the external borders of the EU are stronger, or at least that each and every country has a harmonized system to welcome people who enter the EU, but they don't. And that was made absolutely obvious during the 2015 migration crisis. There's also a security crisis with terrorism. And then, of course, in 2016, you had one country deciding to leave, the UK, and the election of the first US president who was hostile to the project and said so quite clearly during his campaign. So absolutely, it has been a perfect storm for the EU. I would suggest, though, that the fact that it is not quite intact because one country is leaving, but in every other country there's still a very strong commitment to staying in, suggests to me that it's slightly more capable of resisting crises than we thought.
Heather Graby, do we have to, at some point, really talk about the EU in two different dimensions, that it is both an economic union and a political union that requires certain political norms be observed as a condition of entry, that remaining in good standing with the group remains dependent on the maintenance of those norms, that along with the bumps economically that the union has sustained in recent years, there's a crisis over values, whether and how to accept refugees, the rise of ultranationalist right-wing parties in places like Austria, Hungary, Poland. Can this values conversation be sustained inside the European family of nations? Is it in some ways even bigger, more consequential than arguments about agriculture or fisheries or currencies or passports?
The whole values crisis is a really new agenda for the EU, and it's very unclear at this point in time exactly what it's going to lead to, because it's something that was taken for granted for such a long time. From the foundation of the EU with the coal and steel community in 1956 until the end of the Cold War, it was quite shaped around the idea of Western values being something that was shared between the member states from six members until 12 and then eventually 15. And when the new countries which had emerged from communist Central and Eastern Europe joined in 2004 and 2007, there was an assumption that their acceptance of Western values and the idea of the fundamental values of the EU being those of rule of law and fundamental rights, human dignity, equality between men and women, and so on, were simply taken for granted. They were things that everybody agreed to. Progress towards democracy and liberal values was one way. It was linear. And it was the end of history. And there was never really a thought that those values needed to be spelled out into a concrete legal framework, a corpus of law which member states would be held to. There were some concerns about possibly, you know, authoritarian tendencies, and for that reason the EU does have a couple of clauses in its treaty, a couple of articles which refer to procedures for dealing with that, but they were never expected to be used, and they don't give enough detail on what the values really are. That was taken for granted. And now we're seeing a contestation of those values on the important scale of the heads of state in government, with two governments in particular claiming that they want to have a different set of values, although they haven't been so very clear about what those might be beyond saying, well, these are Christian values, which, you know, would that really be at odds with the European values that are there in the treaty? But this is a new discourse, and it's kind of come out of the blue. It wasn't expected, and for that reason, the EU doesn't really have tools to deal with it. It neither has legal mechanisms, which is the thing it usually relies on, nor does it really have political processes. So it's had to create a new, for example, rule of law dialogue in order to try to discuss issues of what happens if a ruling party tries to put political influence over the judiciary in its country. It's had to start thinking about questions like, OK, what happens if academic freedom is affected in a member state? And until very recently, the assumption was electorates would take care of that issue in their own country. They would eventually vote a government out. But what happens if that government starts changing changing the rules of the game domestically in ways that affect both its own constitutional order and also affect the rule of law, which means implementation of EU law. That gives the EU a direct and immediate interest and concern in what's happening in that country, because there are things like mutual recognition of court decisions, automatic extradition of EU citizens from one country to another. All of those kinds of mechanisms at EU level were built on the idea that member states would always be able to trust one another's domestic institutions to be free of political influence and to operate practically, operate properly. Now that that's in question, nobody really knows how to react. And that's why we have such a crisis.
Was it always a little unrealistic to expect rapid, harmonious, and unified points of view from countries as disparate as those emerging from behind the Iron Curtain and those who had been at the core of the European project since the Treaty of Rome?
There's always been enormous diversity across the EU, and that's why the EU set up common rules on economic integration. That's why there's such a detailed set of the famous 100,000 pages of the acquis communautaire of the body of law, which sets out in enormous detail how to regulate markets. So when it comes to products and even services being traded across the EU and capital as well, there's hugely detailed guidance from the EU. Everybody knows what the law is. It's implemented. It's enforced. There's a European Court of Justice and so on. But that body of law never covered issues like what is an independent judiciary, how countries regulate their own media, what's the relationship between government and media. They didn't cover issues like how should the state organize its own separation of powers. These kinds of constitutional issues of democracy were always left for national governments to sort out themselves. So the EU is lacking standards in these areas. There's plenty of regulation from cucumbers to diesel emissions, but there's nothing much on independence of the judiciary for the EU to draw on. And that's why the fight has gone to political level, because it's not easy to put it through a judicial process.
But is it also being carried on at a cultural level? I mean, you are people, you're adults, you're people who have grown up in this world as much as you now analyze it and study it and watch it. Charles Litchfield, when a Bulgarian says, "I'm a European," does he mean the same thing that you do?
I think the fact that these countries were so enthusiastic to join is something that should be remembered. It wasn't necessarily an easy process, and accession was a fairly demanding process where certain benchmarks were imposed on countries, and they had to get, as Heather suggested, all sorts of ducks in a row on how their commercial policy operated, public tendering, the banking legislation. I mean, it is really quite difficult to get up to speed and enter the EU. And the enthusiasm that successive governments had in trying to get there suggests to me that they wanted to be part of a broader project that was meaningful to them. Now, of course, there might also have been a sense that this was a good way to protect individual countries that are towards the east of the European Union from their former, for some of them, occupying power or older brother in Moscow. But I think that there is also a sense that they just wanted to belong to a project which made sense and which was attractive and that signified their transition to democracy and emancipation. And if you ask people what European values mean now, it will obviously be quite vague, but things that come up quite often are freedom of movement, the right to travel and set up your life anywhere in the Union, one big achievement of the EU, the Erasmus student scheme, whereby you can study anywhere in the EU for a year during your studies, is popular as an idea, although too few young Europeans use it. But I suppose if you try to boil down what it means to be a European, there aren't that many sort of objective measures of what you can benefit from as part of the EU, other than freedom to travel, some access to student exchange schemes, and then a general sense that you're in a family of democracies. it is quite hard to find anything objective that people sort of refer to when they think of what it means to be European, which is probably why at this stage it's quite challenging for the core countries, the countries that started the project, to objectively say why they have a problem with governments in the newer member states who are straying from what they would say are the norms of democratic governments.
Would that be a good thing to work on getting moving forward, or can that be left to the vagueness that I just heard? Having a translation for Ode to Joy in your local language is just going to have to be enough for me and Charles Litchfield to have in common.
Well, I think sort of top-down measures whereby the EU tries to sort of instill European identity in its citizens have rarely worked. And this conversation that seems to be present, at least in financial newspapers, about Eurozone reform is very important, given that the Euro's architecture is flawed. But I think that governments have, or rather, especially Mr. Macron of France, has accepted that this isn't really a way to help people reconnect with the European Union, talking about Eurozone reform. You need to identify much more concrete measures.
How about you, Heather Graby? Do you think a Hungarian, a Croat, a Latvian means the same thing you do when you say, I'm a European?
The concept of European identity is very broad and very flexible, and the EU's motto is unity and diversity. I think it's not really about identity. What's happening in terms of the values crisis is about power. What's happening in Hungary and Poland is that parties that have quite a strong ideological agenda and which have won a majority in elections have then sought to increase their own power domestically by overriding the checks and balances in their constitutions and exerting more and more political influence of the executive over other branches of government. So in the case of Poland, particularly to try to take over the judiciary and allow judges to be hired and fired by the justice minister, to review court cases of the past 20 years on the basis of new law, for example. This isn't really to do with European identity. This is a power grab. Similarly, in Hungary, what's going on is an overriding of checks and balances by changing the constitution and by trying to marginalise and quieten independent voices in civil society and academia and in the media. So I think we get a bit over concerned with the whole question of is Europe homogeneous enough. It's not really about homogeneity. It's about what do you need to make economic integration work and also allow for example, police and judicial cooperation if in some countries the government has power over state institutions and which in other countries are kept in check. That's why it's such a big issue for the European Union. It's not about a bit of unpleasant illiberalism in one country or another. It's about the functioning of the community of law. And ultimately, what's happened is the reason why Peace in Poland and Fidesz in Hungary have had enough room to do this in their own countries is they have quite understandably been able to draw on the grievances of the many Poles and Hungarians over the years about inequality and often quite rushed transition in the 1990s, the people who were left behind by it, the very painful reconstruction of the economies and so on, and to build out of that a quite populist nationalist agenda in which they set up the EU as the problem. And so what they now, what I would argue if I were a Pole or Hungarian is, please give us the answers to these problems internally and improve our daily lives. But the problem is by kind of exporting the problem and saying this is all because of the EU and what we need to do is to reassert sovereignty over the EU, you don't actually solve those problems. You create new ones because ultimately their economies benefit enormously from being integrated into the EU's single market. And in fact, either Huxit or Polexit, for those countries to leave the EU would be a disaster for their economies, which is why neither Peace nor Fidesz ever mentions that possibility. Instead, what they're trying to do is to stay inside the European Union, but have one party control of the state within those countries.
But at a time when you've got this kind of ongoing tension inside the Union, you don't have neutral or benign powers to the east and the west. You've got an anti-EU Vladimir Putin to the east, a mercurial at best, anti-EU at worst, Donald Trump to the west. Does that make this whole thing harder. Russia played dirty tricks in encouraging Catalan separatism, stuck its nose into the Czech elections, encouraged Orbán in Hungary. The Five Star Movement and the Liga both favor dropping sanctions against Russia. Is this moment made harder by the fact that now, East and West, these big powers are not rooting for the EU?
It's made it a lot harder because as democracy has become more and more influenced by social media, which carries a lot of conspiracy theory, which carries a lot of, it's easy to carry a lot of misinformation and a lot of confusing messaging, it's actually become harder for voters to see where do my interests really lie? Who's really on my side? That's one of the reasons why populism is flourishing at this moment in time. And in the past, when, for example, President Obama would say, I want a strong EU because that's also good for America, because that's good for global trade, that helped to some extent to kind of show the case for economic integration. It's much harder when Trump is going on a quite different agenda. It's definitely the case that Russian interference in both the German and the Italian election campaigns has contributed to a loss of trust in institutions, a loss of trust in democratic processes, which doesn't help to bring solutions to the problems in those countries. What's tricky now, though, is that the kind of sense of external threat that there is in the EU leads to an argument that we must have unity, we must draw together and be unified. Therefore, let's overlook and gloss over problems inside the union because we want to preserve unity among the 27 member states. There's also Brexit going on, so let's all pull together. And that's been used as an argument not to address the values crisis, not to come to an agreement on migration policy, for example, because it's just too difficult. So a lot of very important issues are being put in the too difficult box in the name of unity, but ultimately they need to be solved. They've really got to be discussed in the union. And even if that means a big fight in the short term, that will actually, I think, make the EU less subject to malign foreign influence in the future.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed on KQED, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. We're hearing from Heather Graby, Executive Director of the Open Society Foundation's European Policy Initiative, and Charles Litchfield, he's European and Eurasian Affairs Specialist with the Eurasia Group. The conversation is moderated by Ray Suarez. And now back to Ray.
One of the harder things to figure, Charles Litchfield, is what are the big power interests here? I've just mentioned anti-EU sentiment from both Vladimir Putin and from Donald Trump. But sometimes it's hard for me to figure why somebody sitting in the Kremlin would be so happy about someone in Barcelona announcing, I'm not really a Spaniard, I'm a Catalan. Somebody in Turin saying, I am a Piemontese, I'm not an Italian. I don't get where the interest is. Or somebody in Washington, frankly, saying, yeah, terrific that Britain is leaving the EU. Yeah, there's going to be some problems up at the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but so what? I don't get it.
Well, I think if we look at those two examples separately, Russia clearly thinks that it can thrive if adverse powers around it, and it always has a sense that any power near to it is an adverse power. Doesn't often, or at least in the Kremlin, doesn't seem to be any sense of me of a win-win solution. It's always very zero sum. The current powers in Russia feel that if the EU is less strong and can be divided, then Moscow will be the most powerful capital in that part of the world. It can deal bilaterally with individual EU capitals, preferably with parties that are sympathetic to it, and it can bully them. This is something that seems to be guiding Russian foreign policy and the activities of various troll factories that can be deployed from St. Petersburg or wherever they sit to destabilize or slightly influence political campaigns wherever in Europe. And it is quite amusing, actually, to go through recent European elections and see which side side Moscow would have supported. And it's not always actually that clear. Obviously, the general rule you should follow is that they tend to be further from the political center. They tend to be against further European integration. They might be nationalist and want to divide one individual country. But actually, if you look at it, sometimes the Russian bots have backed several horses. And there is actually even quite a subtle policy where perhaps the expectation, for instance, in the French election might have been that Russia wanted Mrs. Le Pen to win because she was the populist with the most, with the greatest potential of winning. But actually, it seems quite clear to me that Russia might have been quite satisfied with the centre-right candidate winning, given that he was quite critical of NATO too and had quite a complex relationship with Washington. I'm talking about Mr. Fillon, who lost for other reasons we don't need to go into. So Russia, it's quite easy to caricature the Russian game in Europe, and I think there's some truth to the caricature, but it also has become very sophisticated, and I think that's what's worrying. They, advisors to Mr. Putin know Russian, know European politics much better than I think most Europeans know how Russia works. And that's probably what concerns me the most. As far as the US is concerned, I would disagree perhaps with the suggestion that the US was welcomed Brexit. Certainly Mr. Trump as a campaigner did, but the Washington as a rather conservative power in foreign policy was not very happy about Brexit, not happy to see Britain, which it saw as a sort of liberal voice, perhaps even a mouthpiece for American interests within this important block of powers, the EU, leaving that block. And also you mentioned the specific Northern Ireland case. I think the specialists in the State Department will have said very quickly to the UK that they didn't, to the authorities in London, that they didn't want Brexit to undo the precious and fragile peace in Northern Ireland. As far as the current administration in the US is concerned, again, I think Mr. Trump sees things as in a rather zero-sum game. He has identified various areas which he perceives, where he perceives the trade relationship between the US and the EU to be unfair, and he wants to, using his art of the game, art of the deal, negotiating strategies, try to bully the EU to come to the table. And this reminds me of some of the things that Heather was saying earlier, that the EU is a sort of law-governed organization. Organization, one that depends on a very, very lengthy body of law, the acquis, doesn't really have a way to deal with these kinds of negotiating tactics. It knows that the way the US administration is behaving is questionable from a WTO standpoint, so it will probably take a case to the WTO. But beyond that, all it can say is, no, we will not recognize these threats, and we'll wait and see if we get a permanent exemption from the tariffs that have been threatened. And if we don't get this exemption, then we will retaliate because we're entitled to do so. But it doesn't really have a much more flexible way of engaging with Trump and his unilateral negotiating tactics, which is probably a weakness, but this is how the EU operates. And when you have 28, soon to be 27 member states, you have to fall back on these bodies of law because these countries do cooperate within the EU. It's fairly successful in some areas, but there is also mistrust among the countries. And the reason why they can still carry on working together and share a trade policy is because they fall back on these rather objective rules. So that's the only way it can work.
It seems like European integration, Heather Graby, was the momentum play of the second half of the 20th century, whether it was passport-free movement, the movement of workers around the Union, the right to settle in different places, the Schengen area, people talking and using the phrase ever closer union, which you don't hear very much anymore. And then the brakes got put on, and the brakes got put on in a way that almost said, hey, we now realize we were doing certain things too quickly. But one of the more interesting parts of this whole thing is that the disaffection, sure, it was there in places like Denmark and the Netherlands, but the heaviest disaffection was in places in the East. And yet, no one knows better than a Pole. No one knows better than a Slovak. No one knows better than a Hungarian what it is they escaped in the early 90s. Flirting with the East seems a little counterintuitive.
I think there's not very much flirting with the East going on in most of these countries. Think about the Baltic states, for example. One of the big motivations for joining the European Union for all of Central and Eastern Europe was regaining sovereignty and independence and securing their borders. Poland's borders have never been so secure in two centuries. The Hungarian minorities living in the countries outside Hungary have never had their rights more respected and their cultural heritage more protected. And it's still the case that three quarters of Poles and two thirds of Hungarians very much support EU membership. So the rhetoric of the governments is at times a lot more extreme than the views of the people in these countries. What I think is actually going on is a crisis caused by the permanent weakness of the European Union, which is that it's not a super state. You talked at the very beginning about it being a bureaucratic super government, but in fact, these crises have emerged because of the EU's weakness, because of the incompletion of its projects. When the euro was set up and the Schengen area of passport free travel was established in the 1990s, they were never quite completed because the assumption was member states agree on as much as they can, you get the project going, everybody starts to see the benefits. And then when the need comes, there will be some kind of crisis that will bring a resolution because it will create the motivation for member states to complete the project by putting in place, for example, in the case of the euro, some kind of finance minister, some kind of backstop in terms of liabilities, some kind of stronger governance. And in the case of Schengen, that there would eventually be an EU-wide migration policy and border management. Now, the problem is that the crises that did come from 2008 onwards have been a lot bigger than expected at a moment of less political unity. And instead of the crises bringing resolution, they've brought more crises in their wake. So the migration crisis has moved into being a values crisis. Now, that's partly because of political opportunism, because some politicians saw it as in their interest to pick a fight with the EU rather than to try to come up with common solutions. Okay, that's what politicians do. They look at the incentives that are ahead of them. But what it means is that in a networked world that is highly integrated anyway, the EU finds it very hard to pull together and come up with a common approach when its member states are pulled in different directions and it doesn't really have a central political integrated administration, or it doesn't have political unity. In fact, it has the lowest common denominator of still 28 countries. And that's phenomenally challenging. It's something that broke up, you know, previous attempts at regional integration in many parts of the world. It might still in the future break up the EU. But what has survived at EU level, what's really remarkable, is these common rules and norms. So that's why I think the values crisis is even bigger than the migration crisis or the euro crisis, because it's the common values which have allowed the member states ultimately to see that they're better off hanging together than hanging separately. If the values crisis really drives them apart, it will be very hard to come back around common policies and institutions.
Well, yes, maybe flirting with the East is an overstatement, but certainly the Serbs, who would like to enter the Union but haven't been able to yet, the Orban government in Hungary, even some of the parties in various European governments are far more open, even after the Ukraine crisis and the behavior of Russia in Ukraine, are more open, perhaps more open than the Baltic states, for obvious reasons, for geographical reasons, but open to Russia in a way that you might argue that after the Warsaw Pact, they might not have been.
There was a lot more sensitivity about this immediately after the fall of the Soviet Union because people in these countries had a very recent experience of domination that they didn't want to continue. Times have changed. Generations have changed. People's views of where their interests lie have changed. What I think you have to look at is of all these different foreign influences in the EU, you know, there's Chinese influence, there's Turkish influence, US influence, as well as Russian influence. Which are the ones where people understand what's going on, and which are the ones that start to change the rules of the game and change people's views of democracy and democratic institutions. And that's where the influence of Russia is extremely important. Because as Charles was saying earlier, sometimes there have been sophisticated game, the troll factories supporting different players in different elections. But what has fundamentally driven most of this is an attempt to undermine the trust of European voters in their own democratic systems, including in their own electoral systems, and to reduce their trust in public institutions at national level as well as EU level, reduce their trust in elites as serving their interests. And that is what could undermine the whole EU. Because if you chip away at public trust in institutions, that's what the whole EU system relies on. It relies on elites negotiating bargains among themselves that serve the whole range of national interests across 28 countries. If you can't sustain that at domestic level, it falls apart at EU level very quickly. That's why Russian influence is different from Chinese or American or Turkish or other influences.
Charles Litchfield, did these smaller, poorer, developing democracies on the EU's east expect that things would be a lot better by now, by 2018?
I think there is a feeling of slight disappointment, which is human nature, I suppose. Grass is always greener on the other side. You always get a sense that things could be better. If you look at it through objective indicators, many of these countries have witnessed a huge, huge leap in their in quality of life. Especially in Poland. And so this is why it's been quite upsetting for people observing Poland from Brussels and elsewhere to see the Poles electing a party that is Eurosceptic. But objectively, the standard of living in the member states that have joined the EU has improved. And as I was trying to describe earlier, there's perhaps just a part of human nature which makes them feel that it could be even better and it hasn't improved fast enough. One other thing which I think is perhaps more grounded in reality is a sense among some of these member states, including in their own elite, that they are second-class citizens within the EU, especially in the decision-making process in the EU. There's a feeling that their opinions aren't always listened to, that the way European Union meetings work, where you have to go around a table and listen to the Bulgarian point of view, the Romanian point of view, the Latvian point of view, that a lot of the representatives of the older, bigger member states find this a bit boring and don't really listen. And it is also the case, of course, that the EU can only really work if you have agreement between France and Germany. Recently, the complaint has been that France and Germany can't agree on anything. Now it seems to be that since France and Germany are trying to put together a roadmap for reform, there's a criticism that they're not really letting anyone else get a word in edgeways. And I think this has felt quite strongly, including among the elites of newer member states.
Ah, but since you've said that, is there a sense among people who are drafting, thinking about the future of the EU, that these points of view, this disaffection has to be listened to when framing proposals for the future?
This is always what they'll say. They will say whenever they're asked about the challenges that the EU has gone through, that the EU has to get better at listening to criticism of its citizens, that it has to get better at delivering results. You will hear this whenever someone who is in a position of leadership in the EU, whenever they're asked about the problems, that is exactly what they'll say. In concrete terms, you have several paths that the Commission itself, so this is the sort of main governance body of the EU. Obviously, the member states have a very important role through the Council, but the daily business of the EU is often conducted by the Commission. And the Commission itself has identified different paths the EU can take in the future to try and address some of these criticisms. Does it concentrate simply on being a single market that regulates economic activity and harmonizes economic rules so that you have a level playing field? Does it try to go further? And if it tries to go further, does it try to take all 27 united into the future, or does it allow other countries to create a different path path for themselves that's perhaps not as invested in the political project, precisely in order to adapt to the sort of different levels of enthusiasm towards the EU. So I think it's good news that these different paths have at least been identified, and that they're starting to think in these sort of categories. So what does it mean for defence if we take one route or the other? What does it mean for the single market? What does it mean for citizenship in the EU? I think it's good that they're starting to think about all of this, but obviously not one particular path has been identified yet. There's an election next year for the EU Parliament. Sadly, I think this will still be 27 individual elections where quite often citizens will use them as opportunities to vent their frustrations with the government in power. It seems quite difficult for me for the governments and member states and for the institutions in Brussels to make this about new projects in the EU. This was an ambition that President Macron had when he was first elected. He made a speech in September in Paris in the Sorbonne where he talked about democratic consultations over 2018 and 2019, which would lead to a number of ideas about how to relaunch the European project, and then these ideas would be endorsed in a great democratic exercise, which the EU Parliament election of 2019 would be. It doesn't really look like that's going too well. The democratic consultations haven't really taken off in many countries. That format really worked for Macron's own campaign in France, but at an EU level, it isn't working as well. And then there's obviously the question of how you fit this into one particular list or several different lists running with these sort of ideas that have emanated from democratic consultations. So I think it will be difficult for anyone to identify what direction the EU is going in exactly after the election next year. There'll be some ideas of what European citizens want from the EU, what their expectations are. But as I said, as I was mentioning, there are these different paths between further integration, concentrating on the single market, moving ahead with different coalitions of the willing and allowing some countries not to participate. I don't think that question will be settled by next year at all.
Heather Graby, I'm still trying to get to the bottom of this disaffection. And the different view of elites. I was at a cocktail party recently, which I guess marks me out as an elite in the first place. And I was talking to a Croatian civil servant who talked about the titanic struggle to get Croatia ready for accession, and how he counts it as one of the most satisfying achievements of his career as a public servant, the work he did in getting Croatia ready for accession. I spent a lot of time moving very slowly on a bicycle, so you get to see things close up in a way that you don't when you're speeding along at 75 miles on the highway in Slovenia and Croatia, and saw the blue flag with the gold stars and another reconstruction project, another infrastructure project. Haven't these countries done pretty well by being members of the EU? Does that build down some of the misgivings over some of the difficulties that remain in harmonization?
Over the past couple of decades, there's been a remarkable transformation in Central and Eastern Europe. And the EU's guidance on how the countries had to prepare themselves for membership was a very important part of that transformation, because it catalyzed domestic processes of reform that went much faster and much further than they probably could have done otherwise. It was much easier to get people to pull together, to overcome differences, domestic interest lobbies, and so on, by saying, hey, we've got to do this to join the EU. That's going to bring our country much more prosperity because of access to markets and the EU structural funds, and so on. And that worked largely. The countries joined. Poland has had a growth rate of above 5% a year for a really long time. Average incomes have risen. Overall, the economic benefits have been large. People got the capacity. Individual citizens were able to travel and study and work abroad. They had fantastic opportunities that they just didn't have before. It's also brought some problems, but it also has brought a disappointment because, of course, the widespread enthusiasm for joining the EU was also on the basis of wishful thinking that the EU would provide a panacea to all kinds of social and economic problems, which EU membership was never going to solve. So there was inevitably going to be a period of disappointment after membership. And, you know, it's been a long time now. These countries joined in 2004 and 2007. So, you know, This is, it's been a while for the halo effect, the honeymoon, to wear off. The question is now whether EU membership can be part of the solution rather than simply part of the problem. For some countries, the EU is still very much part of the solution. Think of the Baltic states, where both in terms of their integration into the single market, also the euro, and the kind of implicit security guarantee of the EU is still incredibly important, and it's still mainly a unifying force. Similarly, for Croatia. What's tricky is what's happening now with very divided domestic politics in Poland and Hungary specifically, and the way that the decision of the parties in power there to choose the EU as their enemy, as a sort of external enemy, might actually affect other member states as well. It's hard to see how the political fight will play out in those two particular countries. But they have come up with a form of opposition to the EU that is really unique, novel. In the past, it's always been Euroscepticism and different views at EU level. Think of the UK, which has always been called the awkward partner because it could be incredibly resistant and difficult in council negotiations, not wanting to agree to things, vetoing, etc. But once a law was passed, once an agreement was reached, which everybody signed up to, the UK government could be relied upon always to implement and enforce it, even if it was controversial domestically. That is the thing that has really changed now. That's the thing that changed last September in 2017, when both Poland and Hungary said they were going to disregard a ruling from the Court of Justice of the European Union, one on illegal logging in the case of Poland, the other one on the refugee relocation scheme in the case of Hungary. And they said, the Court of Justice may rule, but we're not going to follow this. We're simply not going to implement EU law. We're not going to comply with it. And non-compliance is very different from flexibility. The EU's always had a lot of flexibility. Member states take part in this project, but not that. You can have projects like the Euro or Schengen, which don't involve all the member states. Fine. But that was agreed. Flexibility was agreed. It was built into the agreements around those projects. Non-compliance is something completely new. Of course, plenty of member states have failed to comply with law before, but that's never become their stated policy. It was something they were kind of embarrassed about. They had to pay fines, and there was pressure on them to comply. But for to have open defiance by a member state government and saying we're not going to apply the law, that really undermines the fundamentals of the EU in a completely new way.
Well, Charles Litchfield, you took a rhetorical nod toward the ability to go your own way, a coalition of the willing. Can you stay in the EU but under your own terms, get all the goodies and not accept the values that come along with the benefits?
Well, as we've observed through the ongoing negotiation the UK is in with the EU about leaving, that is it just will not be possible, will not be available, an arrangement where the UK keeps the economic benefits it's interested in, but none of the obligations. And I think while I think there's quite a lot of goodwill in the EU to create a relationship with the UK that is close, they want to maintain this principle of a balance between benefits and obligations. And if the UK wants fewer obligations, it will get less economic benefits. That seems to be what will drive the architecture of the EU in the future. But then when we talk about coalitions of the willing, it seems to be to me that this is already the case. There are countries that are in Schengen. There are countries that are members of the EU but are not in Schengen. There are even as far as the UK UK, which is leaving, and Denmark are concerned, there are countries that can be in the EU without being members of the Euro. There are other countries that aren't members of the Euro yet but are supposed to join eventually. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is that the EU has already accepted that there will be some divergence. There will be different countries moving at a different speed. The question is whether this can be extended to other parts of the EU, military cooperation, attitudes to refugees. That is a conversation that is ongoing. And I think in order for the EU to progress and to move on, I think it will need to have this kind of flexibility, but at the same time enforce a very strong sense of balance between obligations and benefits. And I think at least for the next 10, 15 years, the idea of further countries coming into the EU seems quite remote to me. I think this was confirmed actually in Bulgaria at the EU summit. President Macron of France said that we're not really ready for new countries to come in. And so for the next 10, 15 years, this is an opportunity for the 27 remaining countries to sort out among themselves what this means as far as coalitions of the willing are concerned. I think there's openness to the idea of different countries progressing at a different speed. But they do need to identify what are core competencies of the EU that you can't really negotiate with. So to give just one example, the EU has been fairly effective as a trade negotiator. I think it seems impossible to me for particular countries to sort of stray from the EU's shared trade policy. That will remain a core competency in Brussels. But then there should be a discussion, I think, about other areas where the EU should perhaps do less or that it should do more, but only bringing some countries with it. I think that's a conversation for the next few years.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Heather Graby of the Open Society Foundation's European Policy Initiative and Charles Litchfield of the Eurasia Group. The conversation was moderated by Ray Suarez, our co-host. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.